held a sit-in rally in front of the house of the journalist Yusuf Abu Hussein, who was killed by Israeli airstrikes during the last escalation in the Gaza Strip.
Yusuf has been targeted inside his home. Israeli regime intends to target journalists in an attempt to hide the truth of this inhuman regime from being delivered to the world. This is totally against international law to target civilians.
There are 24 Palestinian journalists inside Israeli jails, including a female journalist. There are also a huge number of journalists that were injured and others killed while doing their work.
Palestinian journalists and media outlets have always been a direct target of the Israeli regime. Hundreds of journalists have been killed or injured while covering the Israeli crimes in Gaza.
This is a stand to express our support and loyalty to our colleagues who have been killed or arrested by the Israeli regime for only covering the truth. This event is held to highlight that we won't allow the international community to ignore the Israeli crimes committed against journalists. During the last escalation, we lost Yusuf. 35 media institutions were bombed and more than 12 journalists were injured.
Palestinians called on the international media organizations to show solidarity with Palestinian journalists and take steps to provide them with security. During the recent escalation of unrest in Gaza, the Israeli regime has intentionally targeted Palestinian journalists and destroyed several media offices in a bid to block the truth. Palestinians here call on the international community to provide protection and security for journalists and hold Israel accountable for committing atrocities against them. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
This is the second time that the aircraft that belongs to Iran's Mahan Airlines lands here in Kabul International Airport since the beginning of September to deliver tons of humanitarian aids to war-weary Afghans who are experiencing difficult days due to poverty and joblessness.
This is the second time that we have brought some food for the Afghan people. Before the previous time, it was about 25 pounds. 20 tons of food and 5 tons of medicine. This time it is all food.
The flow of humanitarian aid by Iran to Afghanistan is welcomed by all in Afghanistan, saying their country needs more assistance to save the lives of millions of ordinary people who are at risk of hunger and malnutrition. They also believe there must be a transparent process to distribute the aids to most needy ones.
Given that poverty and joblessness are on the rise in Afghanistan, I think it would be better for donors to first provide food and then pay serious attention to the healthcare sector.
We have been receiving international aid since 2001 during the rule of Karzai and Ghani over Afghanistan, but all to no avail, because poverty is still bothering our people. So my suggestion is that these aids must be distributed first among the most vulnerable, poor and jobless people.
Iran has pledged to continue its support to Afghanistan and its people in different economic, humanitarian, political and security fields. This comes as Taliban takeover in mid-August suddenly changed the situation in Afghanistan, and of course, it also brought some major changes in the policies of some Western states, mainly the US toward Afghanistan, such as freezing Afghanistan's assets. The freeze of Afghanistan's reserves by the US is labeled as an illegal move by Washington against ordinary people. That is why Afghans widely condemn the move and ask why ordinary Afghans should pay the price of Washington's defeat in Afghanistan. However, Afghans look to supportive stances and moves of some neighboring countries like Iran as an example of honesty and true cooperation with Afghans. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Britain is witnessing long queues outside fuel stations, including the capital London, following fuel rationing at some distribution centers and temporary closure of many retail stations. British Petroleum said it has closed more than 1,000 of its fuel distribution stations, citing a lack of both unleaded and diesel grades. The multinational gas and oil company blame the closure on a shortage of truck drivers. The government has cautioned against panic buying, saying there is no shortage at refineries. Britons have, however, paid little heed to the pledge, as long queues of motorists have been forming outside filling stations since Saturday morning. Retailers have warned that the clock is ticking for the government and that it only had just days to prevent a significant disruption in festive preparations in the run-up to Christmas, which is only 3 months away. The administration of Prime Minister Boris Johnson says it is looking at temporary measures to address the issue. British media say the government is mulling allowing some 5,000 truckers into Britain on short-term work visas in a bid to alleviate the acute labor shortage. The UK's Road Haulage Association, however, says Britain needs 100,000 drivers to meet the demand. The UK opposition leader has blasted the government for what he called letting the people down amid the fuel crisis.
We're obviously at a crucial time for the country, and this government is letting people down so badly, whether it's hammering working people on tax and universal credit, whether it's shortages of food and fuel. I've just been up the road, three petrol stations, one of them with a massive queue and two of them with no fuel.
The driver shortage is partly blamed on Britain's withdrawal from the European Union, which has resulted in tens of thousands of truckers from EU member states leaving the UK. But it has been exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic. The shortage has also set Britain on path for food chaos, since it has led to disruption in deliveries to supermarkets and fast food chains. The fuel issue comes as Britain is also facing a record high surge in natural gas prices, with wholesale prices being up to 250% since January. Experts say households will get hit by surging power bills this coming winter, while small energy firms are at risk of collapsing. Supermarkets and food firms say the price rise has caused a shortage of carbon dioxide, which is threatening UK supplies of meat and fresh produce.
The United States border with Mexico has witnessed an influx of asylum seekers in recent weeks, with thousands, mostly Haitians, massing there after fleeing poverty in their home country. The migrants reached the Rio Grande after a long, treacherous journey. Images showed people with toddlers staying in squalid tents under a bridge in the Texan border town of Del Rio. But as usual, U.S. authorities began removing and expelling and, in some cases, cracking down on refugees despite criticism at home and abroad. On Thursday, U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti, Daniel Foote, resigned in a fiery letter over what he called inhumane expulsions of asylum seekers. The United Nations also demanded an end to the mass expulsion, with UN Refugee Chief calling it inconsistent with international norms. The United Nations Human Rights Office particularly expressed concern over the ill treatment of migrants at the southern U.S. border.
Like, we are disturbed by the images we've seen, and by the fact that we've seen all these migrants and refugees and asylum seekers being transported to Port-au-Prince. We are seriously concerned by the fact that it appears that there has not been any individual assessment on the case.
Condemnations poured in after images showing predominantly white federal agents on horseback whipping and chasing migrants went viral on social media. Human rights groups say such incidents are reminiscent of the disturbing U.S. history of racial and ethnic violence.
The United States has been in existence. It has exploited African people, no matter where African people have been dispersed around the world by Europeans.
The Mexican president, whose country has been the main transit for U.S.-bound migrants, called on his American counterpart to deal with the root cause of the migrant problem. Andrés Manuel López Obrador urged the U.S. to invest in the countries from where migration originates. As the U.S. continues to grapple with the influx of migrants, it remains to be seen whether the Biden administration prevents the crisis on its southern border in a humane way or continues breaking its promises to welcome migrants into the country.
Nerves are growing more frayed in the EU ahead of winter time.
Gas prices have soared by 250% since the start of the year, and supplies are depleting. Almost half of all gas used in the EU is imported from Russia, but relations between the bloc and Moscow are at an all-time low. Analysts say it's not surprising, therefore, that the Kremlin is reluctant to increase supplies. The crisis has been discussed at a meeting of EU energy ministers attended by senior European Commission officials.
We have to end our dependence on foreign, volatile fossil fuels as soon as possible. We also need to take energy efficiency seriously.
Experts say ordinary, hard-pressed citizens are now paying the price because the EU refuses to dial down its anti-Russia rhetoric.
It's not possible to expect that European Union will export its rules, its behavior, all its values to everybody in this neighborhood. But it seems to me that the feeling here sometimes in the political bodies of the European Union is the following. If others are not taking the internal rules of the European Union, that does mean that they are wrong, that they are incorrect.
Gas prices have shot up due to demand because economies are bouncing back from the pandemic. In the EU, last winter and spring were colder than usual, and so gas reserves in the 27-nation bloc were hit. Since then, power grids have not benefited much from wind energy due to mild weather conditions. Moscow and Berlin want the speedy approval of Nord Stream 2, the controversial pipeline under the Baltic Sea that will double Russian gas exports to Germany. Completed earlier this month, the pipeline cannot start delivering gas until it clears regulatory hurdles here in the European Commission. The United States is very much against the Russian-German gas pipeline, and analysts say Washington is putting the EU under pressure to try and delay things. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Muslims marked Arbaeen, the 40th day that followed the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the third Shia Imam and his 72 strong companions in the Battle of Karbala in what is now southern Iraq in 680 AD. Each year, millions of Muslim mourners set out on a symbolic 80-kilometer-long walk that begins from the holy city of Najaf in Iraq, where Imam Hussein's father Imam Ali's shrine is located, to the holy city of Karbala that houses Imam Hussein's shrine. But this year, due to COVID-19 pandemic, Iraq has imposed restrictions on the number of pilgrims. According to Iranian officials, nearly 60,000 Iranian pilgrims have traveled to Iraq to partake in the huge annual Arbaeen procession. The Arbaeen march is of great significance for Muslims. In Iran, those who cannot make it to Karbala take part in a symbolic march from Tehran to the town of Ray towards the holy shrine of Hazrat Abdul Azim Hassani.
Arbaeen march is one of the largest religious gatherings in the world, which manifests the extent of the age-old love for Imam Hussein and his ideology of resistance against injustice. This year, although the COVID-19 pandemic has either cancelled or restricted most of the mourning processions, our love for Imam Hussein runs deep in our hearts and will never fade away.
The love for Imam Hussein runs in our family. My family and I always take part in such religious ceremonies to remember Imam Hussein, because with his sacrifice, he saved the true Islam. Still after 14 centuries, we honor him as a savior of our religion, and he's the best role model for me and my children.
Over the past decade, the Iranian and Iraqi people have begun participating in what came to be known as the Great Walk of Arbaeen, a procession during which millions of Iranian and Iraqi Shias travel on foot to the shrine city of Karbala, south of Iraq, to renew allegiance with the ideals and teachings of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. The Battle of Karbala featured an unjust fight between Imam Hussein and his army and the hugely outnumbered army of the Umayyad Caliph of the time, Yazid.
The Day of Arbaeen is a day on which the family members of Imam Hussein return to the plain of Karbala to properly bid farewell to their fallen heroes and finally grieve for their loved ones. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Hello. Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Spotlight.
joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's the fourth day of long lines and dry pumps in Britain, and the army's preparing to help with a fuel supply problem. The rise in demand came amid fears of a driver shortage hitting fuel supply. The UK is said to be short of 100,000 truck drivers, causing problems for food suppliers and supermarkets. Now, this is said to be the result of new Brexit visa regulations and also a COVID backlog. Now, let's go to London to our own Amina Taylor, and let's hear her tell us about the situation there. Amina, over to you.
Well, unfortunately, it would have been another worrying day for consumers as they perhaps worried about how they might get to work, to school, and go about their daily lives tomorrow. Because despite Prime Minister Boris Johnson making his first on-camera comments about this, saying the situation was returning to some kind of satisfactory levels, and that consumers must go about their petrol filling business in the normal way in order to help regulate the supplies at the pumps. The Petrol Retailers Association, that's the main group who looks after four courts here, who represent those members, say still nearly 40% of their four courts are empty. Now, if you extrapolate from the information, even if you can find a place with a long line, you're actually in the minority here because a lot of the petrol pumps are running dry. When I filed my story on this yesterday, we drove to six places hoping to speak to people in those long lines, and there were none because the forecourts were empty. So Grant Shapps, the transport secretary here, has placed the blame firmly on hauliers, the haulage industry, and also on consumers for panic buying. But I think the messaging coming out of Downing Street and the government might not really be matching the reality on the ground as people see empty forecourts and, of course, long lines if they're lucky enough to see those. This has also very briefly turned into a political situation with Sir Keir Starmer, leader of the Labour Party, saying he would be handling things in a different way, prioritizing key workers and extending the visa program to ensure experienced HGV drivers from across the UK and EU can actually help alleviate the situation.
Okay, thank you for that. Amina Taylor in London. Now, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. In this edition, we're discussing the fuel crisis in the UK. To do that, I'll be joined by co-founder of the regional investment platform, Justin Urquhart Stewart in London, and filmmaker and activist Ken Farrow, also in London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to the show. Let me start with Justin. A fourth day of long lines, Justin, as you heard, and pump closures as prices rise to eight-year highs. And there are instances of violence between angry customers and tensions as tensions are rising. How bad is the situation, in your opinion?
It's been really quite pathetic when you actually see what's happened and how it's been handled.
But it does vary hugely across the country. There are some areas where I come across, I was in Northfield yesterday, and there were very little issues so much there. But other areas, no, it really has been dreadful. And of course, when people are desperate because they need their transport, maybe it's not just for their work, but for medical issues, all sorts of elements. If people cannot get it, and there are queues growing too long, or, as often you'll find with petrol stations, there are two entrances. So you end up immediately with an argument between two queues as to who's getting what. But that, as you were just, I mean, it was just saying, we've had a distinct lack of political leadership to try and manage our way out of this. This, after all, is nothing new. This was predicted over 18 months ago. And yet we find ourselves in a position where politicians are looking at some surprise, saying, we didn't think this was going to happen. Oh, yes, you did. You just you didn't prepare for it.
Right. Now, our second guest is also joining us, Ken Farrow, filmmaker and activist in London. Good to have you with us, Ken. Boris Johnson's government has announced a series of emergency measures to address the fuel crisis. So how is the fuel crisis being tackled?
Well, it's being tackled quite incompetently, but what we have to remember is that, you know, the crisis itself is not just around fuel, it's around the very infrastructure of the United Kingdom that relies on foreign workers, migrant workers, who were told to leave this country. And so I don't think this is just about fuel. This crisis is about the future of this country in terms of its workforce. It has a diminishing workforce, and this is just the first sign of many things to come. So whatever the government does or doesn't do in this situation, it really isn't going to make any difference in the long run until they address the very fundamental nature of work, workers' rights, the rights of workers who come to Britain. And so that has to be the solution. So the solutions in terms of the army and the small number of licenses being offered, and even those are restricted, are just a smokescreen for the bigger issues here, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Now, Justin, how big a role does Brexit play in this fuel crisis besetting Britain?
I think in many ways it's almost a backdrop to the whole thing. There are many issues which have affected what's happened to this. The pandemic, the pingdemic, as we like to call it, because of the app we have on our phones, and also the level of concern, because people have been off on furlough for so long. But Brexit is lurking behind it. Now, let's be fair, there are a shortage of drivers throughout the whole of Europe, very significant numbers indeed. It's almost a generational issue that people don't want to go back to working in really very poor quality in terms of pay and conditions for such a vital issue. What the pandemic brought out was how weak our supply chains were, not just coming from, say, the Far East and the difficulties there because of the pandemic, let alone from the odd ship getting stuck in the Suez Canal. But actually this issue with regard to domestic supply chains, and it's not just about fuel. There's no shortage of fuel at all, but actually making sure the structure is there to make sure food, essential items are being delivered on time. And people's expectations, of course, over the past few years, have said that they expect it there to be immediately. But this is what's so frustrating about what we've seen with this. Brexit has meant that a proportion of the workforce have gone back. And of course, although the government has come up with a temporary scheme for 3 months, no person in their right mind is going to come back just for 3 months and then probably be told to go home again over the Christmas holiday period. And any politician who's seriously putting that forward as an answer to this is frankly deluded.
Now, Ken, how about COVID-19? You know, coronavirus backlog is also blamed for this fuel problem.
Well, I think the experience of COVID and the way the country fundamentally ground to a halt in terms of economic development acted as a buffer for the impact of Brexit. Now that the country's coming out of COVID and that there's a much more economic activity, people need to start moving around. And so we're beginning to see the impact of the effects of Brexit with this so-called fuel distribution crisis. But also I think we're going to be seeing it in the future in terms of other areas as well. So what essentially happened in COVID is that the country fundamentally shut down to a greater extent. We had stops and starts over different periods, but it didn't really get on its feet in economic terms. And now that we are apparently coming out of COVID and that economic activity is increasing, we have this issue coming up. And I think it's going to the impact of COVID was to act as a as a buffer to the, you know, bad planning, mismanagement, and basically foolish acts of the British government in terms of Brexit.
Okay, Justin, do you share the same view?
Yeah, and Brexit, if you just want a straightforward calculation, you're knocking about 2 billion value off the British economy. Now, billions are one of those numbers that you can't actually, most people can't get their head around. It's a lot of money. And at a time when the economy is supposed to be, you know, trying to recover, you've automatically taken away linkage to the largest trading bloc in the world. Now, this is what is so ridiculous. The largest trading bloc in the world, where Britain was not only a member of, but has significant influence as one of the major powers in it. So actually, this has made the EU significantly weaker as well, because Germany is desperate to reform the EU, but as their previous finance minister said, it's all very well trying to reform it, but they can't do that with Luxembourg and Denmark. They need someone with a big budget and political strength to see it through. So the impact also on the EU is there, but I have to say that the bad handling by our politicians with regard to Brexit, ending up with a populist vote for people voting to leave without really understanding the fundamental issues behind all of this.
Well, unfortunately, we lost a connection with Justin. Let me ask you this. Labour has said that the latest response to the fuel crisis is an admission of failure, and that asking the army to pitch in is a sticking plaster. Do you have the same opinion?
In a sense, I do. I mean, clearly, it's not a solution to distribution, and you know, the British government and the army could very, very quickly solve this situation in terms of physical distribution. But I think what's at stake here, there are two issues that we really need to talk about in relation to your question. One is that Labour have consistently failed the rights of migrant workers, and migrant workers are the very group of people who sustain the infrastructure of the country, whether it's to do with food, whether it's to do with transport, whether it's to do with the National Health Service. So they're a very, very important part of that workforce. And of course, Labour have done nothing to support those groups. And even looking at the party conference at the moment, they're doing very little to actually move forward in terms of that. But I think what we're discussing here is basically, you know, we have a capitalist system which has seen a hiccup. But at the same time, out of every crisis, just as we had the kind of corruption that we witnessed with politicians in Britain in terms of providing jobs and contracts to their friends who exploited the situation in terms of COVID, in terms of PPE, and the supply of medical, we're seeing the same things going on now in terms of the petroleum companies who will benefit from this situation. So I think there's a bigger picture here in terms of just discussing about how do we get the country running again? Well, right. What country do we want to have running again? So I think these are important questions.
Okay, Justin, sorry for that technical problem. We lost our connection for a few seconds. Go ahead with your comments.
So the issue is one of what you find yourself with actually losing your connection with the largest trading bloc in the world is frankly stupid. Because the wealth that actually Britain has acquired since joining the EU was huge, and none of that was properly discussed at the time of the vote. But Britain has benefited when it joined the EU, what was the EEC in those days. It was the poor man of Europe. When we left, we weren't necessarily the richest, but certainly one of the wealthiest, and really seemed to be quite a successful economy, despite many difficult issues and longer-term elements, which Phil has just highlighted there, which weren't being properly addressed in terms of not just low pay, but actually the ability to make sure you've got immigrants coming to work here. Because after all, remember, Britain is an immigrant country. Actually, the entire country is made up of waves upon it, and our success has always been our acceptance of and taking in those people. And we're going to see a lot more of that over the next few years. Bear in mind, we've probably got 300,000 people potentially coming from Hong Kong, which I think will be extremely exciting for Britain. But for the reaction of our politicians, I fear they are far more old-fashioned in their attitudes and more Luddite in their behavior, rather than seeing the economic possibilities this could create.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ken, do you believe that the measures the British government has taken are sufficient to tackle the issue? You know, there are some measures like temporarily exempting fuel companies from competition law.
Well, I think out of every crisis, whether it's man-made or whether it's natural, you know, there are elements within the government and within society that exploit that situation. So I think that there's money being made at the moment out of this crisis, and we can see that just on a basic level in terms of people kind of stocking up on fuel and doing a run on fuel, which now becomes more demanding, more in demand and more expensive, right to the top where you have these companies who have no, who are basically told that, well, you can make as much money as you want to at the moment. So I think all of that is going on. I mean, essentially, that we have a capitalist country. We're talking about how to get it running again. And this is not really the most significant issue here. The most significant issue is the mistreatment of working class people, the mistreatment of immigrants and migrants. And ironically, at the very same time, you know, we had people from the Caribbean, from Jamaica, coming over, invited after the war to work in the NHS on the buses. And there was the Windrush scandal where some of them were asked to return after decades and decades of being settled in the UK. And the ironic thing is, at the moment, the British government is actually out in Jamaica trying to recruit nurses for the shortfall that we have in the National Health Service. So the crisis on fuel is really part of a much bigger crisis this country is experiencing. And it's something that can only be solved if Britain becomes less insular and if the people of Britain accept the fact that the reality of the situation is that politically, culturally, economically, Britain is part of the world, it's international, and it needs to behave like that. Instead of shrinking in and trying to become an island fortress.
Mm-hmm. Justin, let's have your comment on that.
Well, you have to look back at the history of Britain. We may not necessarily be very proud of colonial periods and things like that, but Britain's been its most successful when it has seen itself as an international country operating internationally. Whether that's today in modern financial services and things like that, which of course have been hit by Brexit as well, or in terms of trade, but also in terms of accepting in waves of immigrants who really benefited the economy. Whether you're going back to the periods of the pogroms of Russia at the turn of the 20th century, or whether you're dealing with people coming from Amin's Uganda, you're seeing people who come here and come into society have added astonishing value to it, not just in terms of economic issues, but also in terms of its culture as well. Unfortunately, you then have, it's very easy to whip up, as it were, protectionist, isolationist views, as you saw with President Trump, to be able to say, put America first. Well, actually, no, that's ridiculous. It's much better when a country like Britain realizes it's an international player, that's what it's always done, and it is at most successful when it is at most open to other people, accepting of their cultures, and being able to actually help the economy. And so we're being very short-sighted, unfortunately, if we're just going to bow and let populist politicians get away with it. That's stupid.
Ken, as you know, the average age of drivers in Britain is 55 years old, and they're retiring. And the industry hasn't made that job attractive either. And the UK needs 100,000 truck drivers. So what's the solution?
Well, you know, the solution is not around 100,000. It's not about average age. None of those issues are as important as the fundamental rights of working class people in this country. So whilst any measures the government puts in or the industry suggests are necessary for them to be able to maintain their distribution, maintain their profit making, really the fundamental questions that should come out of this, people should be asking, you know, what kind of country does Britain want to be? How do people want to live? What kind of society do they want? And what do they want to get out of it beyond the selfishness that we've seen, you know, even in terms of the panic buying over the past 3 or 4 days or week? Essentially, you know, every crisis, as Naomi Klein outlined, you know, has the benefit of some people. There will be always people that benefit from the crisis. So there was no need for this fuel, so-called fuel crisis. In fact, it's not even a crisis. You know, it's just an opportunity for the government to reassert its control. And even though they may appear to be, you know, incompetent and stupid and ineffective, they don't really care. The government is making money out of the situation. The government made money out of COVID, and it will continue to make money. People have to remember that this government was voted in and has behaved intolerably since it took power. It's only interested in a very narrow group of people. It's interested in itself out of making money. There's no commitment to community. There's no commitment to the people. And so for people to be asking, the government, the very people who have really abused the country since they took power, is, I think, laughable. And I think people should really not think just beyond filling their petrol up in their car, but really what to do beyond that.
Right. Justin, what's the main part of the problem? Is the driver shortage the main part of the problem or what?
No, it's not. What you've actually got is a huge fragility in terms of the supply system. And where you, as you saw the pandemic, the supply structures were very, very weak indeed. So, you know, people were talking about the impact on holiday presents and such like over a year ago. And this is really before anything to do with truck drivers or anything like that. And bear in mind, the truck drivers issue isn't just a British issue. You've got the same happening throughout Poland, Germany and other elements. Huge numbers shorting. People have not come back to that work. Why? Well, primarily because over the past two decades, you've had people being able to develop the gig economy. That's to say, you are paid immediately for what you do by the hour with very little social responsibility to your position and how your rights are respected. That is now changing. And those drivers are staying, or those obviously retiring, people not going into this part of the industry because it's not paid well enough. Their services are supporting it a very incredibly weak. So why should they bother? There are other things they can go and do. And of course, they can now do that because there are less people around to work because an awful lot have gone back to the rest of Europe, and there is now a, you know, a huge demand. It's not just lorries, but also just look at, say, the service and leisure sector. Mm-hmm. If I go to a restaurant or a pub or something like that, it is immediately noticeable that you have lost probably 25 to 30% of the people who would normally be working there. Because they're not available, they've gone back to Europe, or they turn around and said, I'm not prepared to work, frankly, these tiny pay levels, and therefore there are other things I can go and do, because there are lots of other jobs that will be available, and give them more. So the economy has to change. This is an inflection point, not just in Britain, but also actually in certain areas throughout the rest of Europe as well.
Okay, and that note will come to the end of this edition of the Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We have co-founder of the regional investment platform, Justin Urquhart Stewart, and filmmaker and activist Ken Farrow, both of them in London. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
The limelight.
COVID has claimed more than 600,000 lives in the U.S., and researchers calculated that for every 13 deaths caused by the virus, one child under 18 has lost a parent. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jonelle Alicia Ryder. This article is published under the heading More than 46,000 U.S. children have lost at least one parent to COVID. Stay tuned for more. 5 months after her husband died of COVID, Valerie Villegas can see how grief has wounded her children. Nicholas, the baby who was one and almost weaned when his father died, now wants to nurse at all hours. Robert III regularly collapses into furious tantrums, stopped using the big boy potty, and frets about sick people giving him germs. Aiden, 5, recently announced it's his job to be strong and protect his mom and brothers. Her older kids, Kay Flora, 13, Andrew Vay, 16, and Alexis Vase, 18, are often quiet and sad or angry, depending on the day. The two oldest, gripped by anxiety that makes it difficult to concentrate or sleep, were prescribed antidepressants soon after losing their stepfather. But in a nation where researchers calculate that more than 46,000 children have lost one or both parents to COVID since February 2020, Villegas and other survivors say finding basic services for their bereaved kids, counseling, peer support groups, financial assistance has been difficult, if not impossible. Interviews with nearly 24 researchers, therapists, and other experts on loss and grief, as well as families whose loved ones died of COVID, reveal the extent to which access to grief groups and therapists grew scarce during the pandemic. Providers scrambled to switch from in-person to virtual visits, and waiting lists swelled, often leaving bereft children and their surviving parents to cope on their own. Losing a parent is devastating to a child, said Alisa Label, a San Diego therapist and program manager with Smart Care Behavioral Health Consultation Services. Losing a parent during a pandemic is a special form of torture. Children can receive survivor benefits when a parent dies if that parent worked long enough in a job that required payment of Social Security taxes. During the pandemic, the number of minor children of deceased workers who received new benefits has surged, reaching nearly 200,000 in 2020, up from an average of 180,000 in the previous 3 years. Social Security Administration officials don't track cause of death, but the latest figures mark the most award granted since 1994. COVID deaths undoubtedly fueled that spike, according to SSA's Office of Chief Accuracy. And the number of children eligible for those benefits is surely higher. Only about half of the 2 million children in the U.S. who have lost a parent as of 2014 received the Social Security benefits to which they were entitled, according to a 2019 analysis by David Weaver of the Congressional Budget Office. Counselors said they find many families, and they have no idea that children qualify for benefits when a working parent dies or don't know how to sign up. COVID has claimed more than 600,000 lives in the U.S., and researchers writing in the journal JAMA Pediatrics calculated that for every 13 deaths caused by the virus, one child under 18 has lost a parent. As of June 15th, that would translate into more than 46,000 kids, researchers estimated. Three-quarters of the children are adolescents. The others are under age 10. About 20% of the children who have lost parents are Black, though they make up 14% of the population. There is this shadow pandemic, said Rachel Kidman, an associate professor at Stony Brook University in New York, who was part of the team that found a way to calculate the impact of COVID deaths. There is a huge amount of children who have been bereaved. The Biden administration, which launched a program to help pay funeral costs for COVID victims, did not respond to questions about offering targeted services for families and children. failing to address the growing cohort of bereaved children, whether in a single family or in the U.S. at large, could have long-lasting effects, researchers said. The loss of a parent in childhood has been linked to a higher risk of substance use, mental health problems, poor performance in school, lower college attendance, lower employment, and early death. Bereavement is the most common stress and the most stressful thing people go through in their lives, said clinical psychologist Christopher Lane of UCLA, Duke University National Center for Child Traumatic Stress. It merits the care and concern. Perhaps 10% to 15% of children and others bereaved by COVID might meet the criteria of a new diagnosis, prolonged grief disorder, which can occur when people have a specific long-lasting responses to the death of a loved one. That could mean thousands of children with symptoms that warrant clinical care. This is literally a national, very public health emergency, Lane said. Still, Villegas and others say they have been left largely on their own to navigate a confusing patchwork of community services for their children, even as they struggle with their own grief. I called the counselor at school. She gave me a few little resources on boys and staff, Villegas said. I called some crisis hotline. I called counseling places, but they couldn't help because they had waiting lists and needed insurance. My kids lost their insurance when their dad died, she added. The social disruption and isolation caused by the pandemic overwhelmed grief care providers too. Across the U.S., nonprofit agencies that specialize in childhood grief said they have scrambled to meet the need and to switch from in-person to virtual engagement. It was a huge challenge. It was very far into the way we work, said Vicky Jay, CEO of the National Alliance for Grieving Children. Grief work is based on relationships, and it's very hard to get a relationship with a piece of machinery. At Experience Camps, which each year offers free week-long camps to about 1,000 bereaved kids across the country, the waiting list has grown more than 100% since 2020, said Tyler Bosch, an Experience Camps associate. It is something that we are concerned about. A lot of kids are not getting the support they need, she said. Private counselors, too, have been swamped. Jill Johnson Young, co-owner of Central Counseling Services in Riverside, California, said her nearly 3,000 Trappists have been booked solid for months. I don't know a Trappist in the area who isn't full right now, she said. Dr. Sandra McGowan-Watts, 47, a family practice doctor in Chicago, lost her husband, Stephen, to COVID in May 2020. She feels fortunate to have found an online Trappist for her daughter, Justice, who helped explain why the 12-year-old was suddenly so sad in the mornings. My husband was the one who woke up her for school. He helped her get ready for school. Justice was also able to get a spot at an experience camp session this summer. I'm nervous about going to camp, but I'm excited about meeting new kids who have also lost someone close in their life, she said. Jamie Stacy, 42, of San Jose, California, was connected with an online counselor for her daughter, but she said it was not enough.
Good morning.
from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.